a sound. Logic podcast.
Two guys with no credentials.
Reviewing Rolling Stone 500.
Greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us once again here at the SoundLogic Podcast. And today we are discussing album number 102 on Rolling Stone Magazine's Top 500 Greatest Albums list. This is the self-titled debut from The Clash.
I can't tell if London's burning, but it has taken us a while to get around to this one. I don't know what it is. Like, we've both expressed before that we've got some punk in our formative music years. We had a fun time with Dustin the last time we talked about The Clash, but for whatever reason, it's taken us... It's been a grind just, like, getting this date on the calendar, first and foremost. And I don't know if it's because we're not excited about it or because... Life just got busy this summer, but anyway, we're here now, and I'm sure we'll have a good time because we always do.
We always do, and I mean, this is fun music. But Ben, we always, we both have younger families, and the summer I think we just have a lot of other things happening. So let's chalk it up to that. Let's not make it about.
It's not about the music.
No. Do you want to just jump into some details first?
I would love
before
to.
Before we get going, okay, let's do it. Okay, The Clash, the self-titled debut album from the band of the same name, released April 8th, 1977, was written by Joe Strummer and Mick Jones, who, I guess if you don't know, is my name, Mike Jones, but Mick is a short form of Mike, so I just thought I'd throw that in.
You're Mick Jones.
I am Mick Jones, or he's Mike.
Thanks for clarifying that, Mick.
Yeah, no problem. They wrote all the songs except for Police and Thieves. So those two, which I believe are the vocalist and guitarist. And it charted, went to number 12 in the UK and went to 126 in the US. I'm going to talk about the US in just a few moments as well. Certified to date, the numbers say 600,000. So much, much smaller numbers than some of the other albums we've reviewed. Okay, this album was recorded and mixed February the same year, over 3 weeks, and cost reportedly £4,000.
Amazing.
Like, you can barely rent an apartment in Toronto right now for $4,000. So that just perspective. Even in 77, that was just peanuts to record an album. The album wasn't released in the US until 79, so 2 years later. And it actually made it their second US release because they had already done their second album and it was released right away. So then they released this, which was their second US release. And we see that it made the chart but didn't go to as far up as the UK release did. The US version also included a significantly different track listing, changing the track order and swapping out several songs for non-album tracks recorded in the interim. So there's always different reasons. By the time you get to the 70s, you don't have that as much. We have a lot in the 60s and certainly before that, where record labels don't necessarily have offices in all over the world. So it's up to another entity or sometimes even just bootleg people like the Beatles, like just other releases in other countries. Like, it wasn't actually the album. It was like, here, the newest sound from the Beatles, and there's just all these songs. It's not actually the album. In the 70s, we don't have it as much. This is kind of odd that the album just doesn't get released for a few years, but maybe they just didn't think it would be popular. Who knows? I'm sure there's answers there, but I just don't have them right now. Okay, talk about the album artwork. It's, as always, look it up if you're not familiar. It's a photograph, black and white. It looks like it's been ripped out of a newspaper. It's kind of got this design. and it's as if it's on a piece of green paper. So the background of the album is green. It's on the edges on left and right, and at the bottom the Clash and kind of block capital, almost comic strip type lettering font, and looks as if it's been gone over with eraser. So there's marks missing in red, kind of a reddy, kind of an orangey red, I guess, the Clash. So that really jumps out. Couple interesting things about this image. Cool image. It's like they're in an alley, okay? So it's the three of them in an alley. Interesting that there's three of them. Now, first thing I want to say is you mentioned earlier that when we talked about London Calling, way back in the day when we first started this, because it was number 8, I think, on the first list, we had our good friend Dustin Wood join us. I right. think the guy on the left looks a lot like a young Dustin Wood.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. And I think they're like, they're posing in an iconic punk way too. The sort of tight pants, tight jeans, some cool jacket with a popped collar, and sort of not really smiling.
Yeah.
I'm too cool for this look with your legs kind of spread. Dustin was in a number of bands that we chased around Southern Ontario when we were in high school, and I think a few of the album covers he was on, he would have had a very similar pose to this.
Yeah, it's that, it's not happy, it's not sad, it's not angry, it's that very I don't care kind of look. Very
yes,
common.
Exactly.
Okay, so the photograph was shot by Kate Simon. It was taken in the alleyway directly opposite the front door of the band's rehearsal building in Camden Market, in, I'm assuming, London. Now, drummer Terry Chimes, though he was a full member of the Clash at the time, did not appear in the picture. He had already decided to leave the group.
Wow.
So I guess, yeah, from the time it was recorded to the time this picture was taken, he had already taken off. So he's not on the cover. Yeah, there you go, right? And another picture from the same photo shoot appears on the UK special edition DVD of Rude Boy, released in 2003, which was I guess, a documentary, I think. The picture on the back cover of the album is a picture of charging police officers shot by Rocco McCauley. And that was taken during the 1976 riot at the Notting Hill Carnival, which was the inspiration for the track on the album called White Riot. So even we don't often miss the back cover. The back cover can be equally as cool and interesting. So that's both photographs. So there's some background on the album cover. Kind of, yeah, you're right. Very stereotypical early punk.
Yeah.
Cover. It's kind of what I would expect from a cover.
But something that lingered. Like, this is from 1977.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the 90s punk and pop punk and Christian punk that we were listening to would have still strived for this vibe.
Yeah.
20 years later.
And it's not a thing where you can say, well, it was everywhere. Well, no, it wasn't. Because you think about rock and roll, these aggressive rock and roll, you know, things, or something very moody. No, it's like, you're right, it's very distinct, very, very uniquely punk. Love it. Okay.
I mean, so, just as you're saying that, like, thinking about the context that 1977, that's rumors, that's Steely Dan's Asia. This does not look anything like that, right? Like, this is a different kind of vibe here. The Ramones, I guess we've already talked about their self-titled debut. I think a year before, but yeah, punk is still this fringy kind of thing that's kind of breaking through.
And as we move into the music, you hear it in the production, because you get Asia, you get Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, you get this polished, well-produced, you get Hotel California, I think, around this time, right?
Like
76, 77, or something, somewhere around there. So, but they also had the budget and the notoriety, the experience to do that. and these guys didn't. You know, they had nothing. They were kids, you know, playing in a garage or rehearsal studio or wherever they could. You know, when we talk about, you know, like Nirvana and garage bands, and like it's a little easier in the suburbs of, you know, Seattle or wherever in the Midwest to, you know, just play in a subdivision. It's a little different in the crowded apartments of London to, you know, just start a punk band without having the cops called on you. So yeah, it's a very, very different, very different idea. And actually, as I mentioned that, I read another note. It said most of the album was conceived on the 18th floor of a council high-rise on London's Harrow Road in a flat that was rented by Mick Jones's grandmother, who frequently went to see their live concerts. Can you imagine, awesome, like a British Nana in 1977 going to punk shows like this? This new underground, probably very seedy genre. Granny's there. That's just awesome. And then the album was recorded over 3 weekend sessions. Wow, so cool. Okay, so we've got 14 tracks. So typical, like we often talk about kind of the sweet spot, like maybe 10 tracks, 12 tracks, and the time. But because it's very common of punk rock, the tracks are so short.
Right.
They actually, they were almost done, and they added more because they felt that it was too short. So they had to add more songs.
It's still 14 songs clocks in at 35 minutes, which is
right?
pretty incredible, especially since they have a 6-minute song on the album. The rest of it is all pretty, pretty concise.
Yeah. Yeah, really, I guess, you know, you get to the point. Also the tempo, right? The tempo of punk rock is fast. You can get through like a couple verses and two or three choruses in a very short amount of time because they're going so fast, right?
Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, so let's talk about these songs, Ben. And first, I want to know, we're familiar with punk. We listened to some punk, although not as much as we might have thought we did when we were younger, as we're discovering through listening to this list, and not some of the more iconic, you know, forebears of punk rock music. But had you listened to this album before?
No, this is new to me. And I expected, since it was on this list, that I'd know a few songs. I think just one track, maybe White Riot, is one that I think I would have heard of before. It was pretty new to me, considering it was their breakthrough debut. And
yeah,
you know, I actually think I shared that an apartment I lived in after college had a copy of London Calling left behind, and so sort of by accident, I discovered that album. But
right,
this one, I think maybe because of how familiar that one was, I sort of assumed, oh yeah, another Clash album. I'm sure there'll be some songs here. And nope.
Not really. I'm in the exact same boat, except I didn't have a copy of London Calling left behind in an apartment.
Had you heard White Riot or any of the other tracks? Has anything seemed familiar? Or, I know
no,
it's got a sound that seems familiar in general, but
I want to say something though about the sound, and really it's more about me. When you say Sex Pistols, Ramones, you know, bands like that, I expected to hear something like this. When you say The Clash, I'm really, you know, when I think of The Clash and my experience listening to The Clash, mostly on radio, is, you know, London Calling, Train in Vain, Rock the Casbah. It's more getting, it's more in post-punk, right? Post-punk going into the 80s, right? So,
yeah.
So this, although this is their roots and this is how they started, and then they evolved into that, which is a little different, this is not what I think of when I think of The Clash. And that all has to do with my ignorance and my inexperience listening to their music, so it's nothing to do with that. But I guess that's kind of what we were, like, when you hear the radio, like, even today, they play The Clash, but they don't play this.
Right.
They play
right.
that and other stuff, right?
I think The Clash, in my head at least, draws in a little bit more on reggae, ska, some sort of like Caribbean vibes that I don't hear as much. This, you're right. This is a lot more straight up Ramon style punk rock here on this album, and I wasn't expecting that either.
You do hear a bit of the reggae in this,
a little bit.
Yeah, a bit in the bass line.
Some up chords. I don't know if there's a technical name for it, but that ska style guitar, I guess.
I think they're called upchucks.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
Serious?
No.
You're going to lean in there.
No.
I would have bought it. I'm So Bored in the USA is the one that I was drawn to that song for some reason, but I think that one in particular has a bit more of like a. They're playing with timing a little bit more there. It's a bit more melodic. Something else happening there than just the three chord punk.
Yeah, I also noticed, and I read as I was reading, you know, different reviews and just overview, that there is a musical diversity here. The other thing, when we think about punk and early punk, this whole idea, and it's mostly true of, you know, it's guys who couldn't play instruments, it's guys who wanted to make a statement. It was about not being polished. That's the whole thing, and that might be true for some, but it was not true for the whole thing. And then you get people who are talented who maybe start that way, but then find, hey, I really have a thing, and maybe take some lessons or just have more experience and get better. So I find when I listen to old punk rock, I have that idea in my head that these are people who aren't real musicians, who don't know how to play their music, and I can't shake that. I guess that idea was put in my head way back, and I can't really shake it because it's not always true. I think it was true sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think the Sex Pistols were more kind of like that, where they, and it was really like their whole thing was just a big screw you to everything that they weren't, you know, to the music industry, to government, to everything. These guys, it's a little different. There's still all those political ideas are there. It's a very political album. If you can, it's probably best if you read the lyrics, because I find it hard to get them all, and it doesn't sound like, you know, someone's reading a political agenda or, you know, some side of manifesto the way they're singing it. But some of it's pretty pointed, and they're talking about, you know, events and the government. One song, you know, I think career opportunities, I hate the RAF and all this stuff, but the Royal Air Force. So anyways, sidetrack. It's okay. I guess it's all about the band. It's all about the band we're talking about this time, which is a
that's right.
An improvement from other conversations. anything that jumped out, I know you said I'm So Bored with the USA. Jumped out at you.
There's a little riff in there, the that kind of caught me a bit by surprise. Something about Protex Blue, which I didn't think much about the lyrics, but that song also a little bit outside the rest of the album. It still sounds very punk rock, but it's got like a pace to it that, I don't know, is a little bit more frantic or something like that. It's scattered. Kind of stood out to me as well. That 6 minute track is one that kind of sticks out. I was interested to hear you say that it wasn't one that was written in the same way as the rest of the album, because it's 6 minutes, you know, almost twice as long as, or three times as long as some of the tracks, and
yeah.
and not necessarily put together in the same way, but it it's got an interesting vibe comparatively to quite a bit slower pace than most of the other songs. So there are a few here that do like separate it, you know, from the what sometimes feels like repetition on the Ramones or Sex Pistols albums. There's a little bit more diversity, but maybe not as much as I found with London Calling.
Right. I would agree with that. Should we sort of talk about, should we pick our two favorite songs?
Sure.
At this point, if you're new, we have a playlist on Spotify called Sound Logic Favorites. We pick two tracks for every song, every album that we review, and put it on the list. So you can go check it out. It's an extremely, extremely large and diverse playlist at this point. So we're gonna add two more there. Ben, do you have a favorite? Is it?
I think I'll go with "I'm So Bored in the USA."
Yeah. I thought you might say that, or maybe White Riot. I think
it's White Riot. Think, okay to say.
Oh.
No, I'm just being a little facetious here. I haven't dug into it enough, but it did make me think, like, man, I wonder if skinheads have ever adopted this song. It's like a refrain. I don't know. Again, we're not lyrics first people. We apologize. I'm sure there's something really cool and punk rock and subversive about it. But yeah, it's a funny name.
I'm going to go with Career Opportunities.
New job.
I like the snare stuff that's have the double hits on the snares. I love the bass work on all of this album. It's a fast paced moving bass line. You know, more than I would expect on my stereotypical idea of what an early punk album would sound like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get that reggae influence, swacking bass line. Doubled, like stuff like that, right? But you get even more than that too, so it's good. Yeah, career opportunities. I like that one. It's a good one.
Perfect.
It's different. There's like different things happening in it. Yeah. I feel like this album's growing on me. Like when it first couple times I listened to it, I was like, eh. Okay, it's an early punk album. I get it. Okay, all right. You know, like,
yeah.
But
yeah.
But the more I listen to it, like, I see there is quite a lot happening here. There's more, more than I think I realized on the first few listens. So I think I'm gonna have to return to this and give.
I don't know what it is about this genre, but I really need to be in the right frame of mind. I've got it in my headphones right now. I'm really enjoying it more so than I remember leading up to this conversation. But I had a similar experience recently where, like, I was really just craving Five Iron Frenzy, this Christian ska band that we listen to a lot. And I saw a Facebook ad that they have a new album coming out. And I was like, really?
What?
They do? And I went to their Spotify and listened to some of the old stuff that we used to listen to. And I don't think I ever got to their newer music. But
you didn't pull out some old CDs there, bud?
I might have. You know what? I might have done that. I don't remember the particular day if our youngest had stolen the iPad for his podcast, but he might have, and I might have pulled out some actual physical media.
Yeah, physical media. It's weird that that's the thing. Oh man! Oh, you shouldn't have said that. Now my brain's just swimming with.
Time and space like plays a big role. I don't want to have this on in the background while I'm relaxing. I could see like try to, you know, put it on while I'm on a really intense bike ride or something like that. And
sure.
Try to grind up the hill.
Oh man. Grinding up the hill. That's why I don't bike. I don't need that. I could, yeah. Or maybe like got the earbuds in when I'm vacuuming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really getting those corners.
Yeah, I find that a lot of people, okay, like, I guess when I say people, I mean my immediate family, don't really enjoy this type of music. So
people
specifically the three people I live with. So I probably wouldn't listen to this too often, you know, if it's not in headphones. But no, it's sure. It's been fun coming, because as you said, Ben, there was a time in my life when I just loved this kind of stuff. Now we weren't really, you know, it was before, a little bit before the days of streaming and things like Napster. So we weren't exposed to this stuff, but we were listening to the punk, you know, third wave punk in the mid to late 90s. So there is still a soft spot for stuff like this. And there's still part of me that does, like you said, it does kind of crave it from time to time, just this kind of energy and idea. And I think the one thing I forget, and it was actually good listening to this and reading some of the lyrics, I forget that there's a strong and important political message in a lot of this stuff. Even something like the Sex Pistols, because I think a lot of times they kind of get dismissed as, like, you know, immature and rash. But there's, like, important messages there. And at times, like, well thought out and formulated, you know. And even if it comes from a place of youth or anger, you know, it doesn't mean that it's not valid. It doesn't mean that it's not important. It doesn't mean that it's not still relevant today. These voices are really relevant. It's our,
right,
you know, as the boomers retire and the Gen Xers get closer and closer to that, and as us millennials and Gen Zs start moving into places of power, it's these young voices that are really, really important. So yeah, it's still relevant. I guess I'm skipping ahead, but that's
I like that. And I think we need that reminder that music can be that. I think we've talked a few times about our somewhat surprise at the lack of protest songs that have come out of the Trump administration. And maybe they're still being written, maybe they are out and I just haven't heard them in the right context. As much as I think I would have expected this moment to bring.
Yeah.
Being reminded that music can be used in this powerful way, even if it's not actually making a difference in the world, but just letting someone vent, almost in the way that Peter talked about certain elements of metal, where, you know, just space for me to let go and my life is really terrible.
Right.
Yeah, there's something about that I don't want to let go of or forget about or think it doesn't exist. It still does and still is present in a lot of music that's out there. It's just not necessarily music I'm engaging with right now.
Right. That's the thing, you know, there's some of it you have to seek it out. You have to seek it out. It doesn't necessarily fall in your lap. So moving on. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the relevance. Maybe I'll toss it over to you, Ben. What has aged well here? And what hasn't aged well?
I think it is more about the attitude that I want to continue on, and using music as a way, being reminded of the way music can express thoughts, values, opinions in a powerful and emotive way. I think it's actually a pretty nicely polished album. Some of the guitar work is a little fuzzy, but the bass sounds great, like you're saying. The
bass does sound good.
Snare, anything wrong with a snare? It sounds pretty well produced for something that cost $4,000 and was kind of thrown together. And I think that's aged pretty well. I'm not really into the punk scene these days, so I'm assuming music just like this is still being created and shared.
Yeah.
And, played in certain similar punk spaces. I don't know what those are, but I assume if there are still punk bands out there, still happening.
yeah, I would agree with you. I was thinking that many sounds and ideas in general, many sounds and musical ideas from early punk rock, I believe have resurfaced over the years. And I think you could go to any decade since this came out and find a part of it in across genres.
At any given
time. I think, you know, obviously there was more punk and post-punk in the 80s. In the 90s, you get punk and grunge. You know, you get elements of this in grunge. You get in the 2000s, you get into, you know, bands like The Strokes and The Hives and other bands that lean, and even into the you know, more recent years, you get acts like, this is an act I really don't prefer, but an act like Machine Gun Kelly, who is kind of blending pop and punk and indie.
Yeah,
and
good
stuff
point.
Is popular. I'm not really a fan at all, but you hear elements of this in music throughout the last five decades. That's not necessarily punk rock music. So I think in those regards, musically it's relevant. In terms of the image, we talked about the image on the cover. That's continued. You still find that. It's funny that you talked about production. I would say production quality is the only thing. I think not necessarily to say that it's bad, but the type of sound that we hear. I think you would hear something even into the 80s much clearer, very different sounding. This is a very thin sound.
It's very stripped down too. They've
very
not
stripped down.
Done much with layering.
I think if you did something like this today or even 30 years ago, it would be, you know, extremely obviously intentional. Whereas this, I don't think was necessarily intentional. I think it was due to the resources they had. I don't think it was like, oh, we could do something that sounds totally different or quote better, but we've decided, no, I think this is the sound we have or the sound that we want or whatever. And like I said, they didn't have the resources of a Fleetwood Mac or or a Stevie Wonder, who was produced. You know, I think Songs of the Key of Life was around this time, right?
Right around the same time. Yep.
You know, so they didn't have those resources, so you get this sound, right? And again, it's not a bad sound. It's actually, for £4,000, is quite a good sound.
Yep.
It's really good, actually. But I think it does date it, and I think you wouldn't really hear something that in production terms would sound like this. And I think if you did hear this on the radio, something sounding like this, not the music, but just the whole mix, I think it would sound out of place. So that would be the only thing. And that's not necessarily, and I don't know 100%, but that's not necessarily a choice that they made. It's just circumstance, right? So, that was the thing for me, but so many other things, I think are still relevant. I think that punk rock, although it's been, you know, popularized at times, you know, it's been mainstream at times, I think it has a place. You know, you can hear punk rock, whether it's this, whether it's, you know, some 41 or Avril Lavigne from the 2000s or something a little more recent, like I said, Machine Gun Kelly. You know, it's around. It's always been around. It never really totally disappeared, even at times when it wasn't mainstream or wasn't popular or whatever, right? Okay, so we talked a bit about how it's aged. I think we got... I probably said more than I needed to there, which is typical of me. We come to the ranking, number 102. Yeah. Ben, how do you feel about this ranking now? I wanted to add that London Calling had originally been number 8 and moved down only to 16. This was originally 77, then 78, then 81. And then on this list, drops down to 102. So you don't have to comment on any of those things, Ben. Just give me a little context. But how do you feel about the ranking here at 102nd greatest album ever.
I mean, I guess this makes me want to ask more questions. Like, it's amazing that an album made for 4,000 pounds winds up here.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. Time.
But I listen to this and find myself wanting the Clash that comes after this.
Right.
The album I know better, the one that is ranked higher on this list. And so to me, this is not great. This is the Clash before they became the Clash that I want to listen to. And so I guess these are the moments where I wish we had a real expert telling us, like, here's how this changed music.
Yeah, here's why.
You know, broke the mold, and here's why it is here. Because to me, it's too high. It feels like what I felt like we got a lot on the 2012 list, which was albums placed there for their impact on the industry rather than greatness that has stood the test of time. It's not uncommon for me to hear Fleetwood Mac's Rumours being played at a college party on a lawn somewhere in our town during the summer. It's still great enough that young people think it's worth listening to. I don't know why this is considered great, if it's just for the impact or if it's actually still feels great to people. And maybe those two things are the same thing for some folks. They're different for me, and I struggle a little bit with that dynamic too.
Yeah, that's I feel some of that struggle as well. I don't know that I personally need this to be at 102. And I struggle with why is this so good? Is it just the influence? Is it just, you know, another paragraph in a music history book? Is that why that's here, or is it actually good and significant and important to people? I mean, I guess in some ways all that doesn't matter, but in other ways, it really does. I guess that, as you said, the Clash that I've been exposed to, and maybe a lot of people, is not this version of the band. It's the version that comes a few years later. And, you know, it's the London Calling, Train in Vain, stuff like that. I don't need it to be this high. I think it's great. Like you said, I think it's great that it's this high. But in some ways, I feel that when you get outside of the the top 100 or even the top 50, maybe it's kind of like, okay, well, it's all just kind of, it's all there, right? It's all important. It's like,
right.
You know, we could split hairs about, you know, the top five albums here. Are we going to split hairs between what's 100 and what's 150? I don't know. So and maybe that's not fair, but at the same time, like, it is important. It's an important album. It's important for what built up this band to be what they were. I'll allow it.
I like that.
Insert Senor Chang quote there.
Senor Chang, can you do something about this?
I'll allow it.
I guess that brings us pretty much to the end now. The only thing we did talk about, London Calling is number 16. The debut is at 102. They have one more. Sandinista. I don't know if I'm saying the right. Sandinista! Exclamation mark. From 1980. It comes in at 323. That one had previously been 407, so that's bumped way up. So...
Interesting.
We'll talk about it again, you know, in like 5 years when we get that far.
That's where Outkast is from, right? No, that's Stankonia.
great pull. I like it. I think you're thinking about Sublime.
Oh.
Oh wait, that's
Santeria. It's getting late.
Any final comments, Ben?
We've said it all. Yeah, to have a 36-minute album and to have our review take about 36 minutes.
Hey.
There's something poetic about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this review. Ben, would you please tell us what we're listening to next week?
Yeah, we continue through the triple digits here. Number 103 on Rolling Stone's 2020 Top 500 album list is 3 Feet High and Rising by De La Soul, which, as you may remember, is a band Mike saw live once at a family-friendly festival. I'm sure we'll have some good insights based on that experience.
Yeah, one of the very few bands on this list that either one of us has seen live. And timing was good because one of the members is no longer with us. So we'll talk about all that and more next week on the Sound Logic podcast. In the meantime, we hope you continue to be well. We hope you take care of yourselves and those around you, those important to you. And we certainly hope that you'll join us next time right here on the Sound Logic podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone. Do take care. If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our Sound Logic podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.